Hello, everyone. I'm Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm just popping in to tell you about my new book series, Which Way to Anywhere. It's a story about four children who discover that there are alternative worlds beyond our own, and that they can travel to them with the help of a magical map and a very special gift. Of course, this leads to epic, unexpected adventures. Which Way to Anywhere and its sequel, Which Way Round the Galaxy, are both available to buy now. Happy reading!
This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, welcome along. Fantastic to have you here for an episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Yeah, my name's Dan. This is our quick trip all around the whole universe. We have a skim through the most amazing, weird and wonderful stuff that we can find. And then when we see something that's particularly dangerous and deadly, we kind of stop, have a breath and take a closer look. This week we'll have a look at one of the most mean killers in the animal kingdom. Also, we'll chat about the simple steps that you can do to help save the world. And we'll speak to an expert about the science behind being a superhero. That's on the way after we catch up with our own science expert, Professor Hallux, who's having a deep look inside your gob.
Professor Hallux's digital dental depository, with support from Philips Sonicare.
What are you working on, Professor?
You remember my dear old Uncle Halitosis?
The dentist.
That's right. It's nearly his 100th birthday, and in his honour, I'm creating a pop-up digital dental depository, an oral health help desk, if you like. I'm going to see how many questions all about teeth I can answer against the clock. Give us a hand, will you, Nanobot? Just needs winding up. Here you go. You can ask the questions.
Okay, first question. Why do we need to clean our teeth?
Well, that's easy. The food and drink that you eat encourages germs called bacteria to grow in our mouths and on your teeth. Left to their own devices, this bacteria can form a soft yellow substance on your teeth. This is called plaque, and plaque can damage the surface of your teeth, eating away at the enamel, causing decay and toothache. Not forgetting gum disease. Or bad breath.
Strong start, Professor. Next question. How often should you brush your teeth and for how long?
You should brush your teeth after breakfast and after supper before you go to bed. 2 minutes twice a day. To help make sure you're giving each tooth the best clean possible, most electric toothbrushes have a 2 minute timer. And you need to remember to clean every part of your teeth. So that's brushing the inside surfaces, the outside surfaces, the chewing surfaces, and not forgetting the gaps between your teeth. It's a good idea to brush at a 45 degree angle to your teeth, starting at the gum line, and then using a gentle circular motion, move your brush up and down each tooth.
Well done, you're doing grand. Oh, tricky question this one. True or false? You should rinse your mouth with water after brushing your teeth.
Ha! A trick question. You might think you should rinse your mouth out after brushing your teeth, but you shouldn't. It'll only wash away the concentrated fluoride in any remaining toothpaste, reducing its preventative effects.
Better hurry, just a couple more to go. Mouthwash or not?
Yep, mouthwashes are helpful. Although make sure you use one which is appropriate for your age and choose one with fluoride. It can be a good idea to use mouthwash at a different time of the day to when you brush your teeth. So say use a mouthwash after lunch. But remember, don't eat or drink for 30 minutes after using a fluoride mouthwash, or otherwise the benefits are washed away.
Flossing. Give us the lowdown.
Well, flossing isn't just for dislodging food wedged between your teeth. Regular flossing can help reduce the risk of gum disease and bad breath by removing plaque that forms along the gum line. There are loads of ways to floss. From dental tape and interdental brushes to the very latest technology where you use bursts of air and water or mouthwash to blast between the gaps. And did you know? It's best to floss before brushing your teeth.
And finally, for a bonus point, what about toothpicks?
Definitely avoid wooden toothpicks. They can splinter and cause damage to your gums.
Time Time's up. Brilliant, Professor. A very respectable score there and lots of dental data for the Digital Dental Depository.
Professor Hallex's Digital Dental Depository with support from Philips Sonicare. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Hallex.
Massive hello to William, who's listening in Australia. Hey, William. He listens in the car and before he goes to bed, which is a brilliant idea, sticking on the podcast when you're trying to drift off, because then your brain's absorbing all this incredibly smart science stuff and it'll be whirring it round through your mind, thinking things over while you're asleep, doing half the work of learning so you don't really have to. William's been on the iTunes podcast store. He's left the Fun Kids Science Weekly a review, which is the best place to go if you've got a science question that you want answered by a proper expert. And he's asked, why does helium make balloons go higher when you let one go? It's all to do with how heavy the air is, William. It's because helium is quite a light gas, and it's heavier than what's usually in a balloon, which is a mixture of your breath. So oxygen, carbon dioxide, some nitrogen in there as well. That's pretty much why, but I will get a proper science expert to come on this show and to answer it for you in the next few weeks. Thanks so much for getting in touch, William. If you want a shout-out on the show, if you've got a science question that you really want answered, remember, the best place that you can let me know is on the iTunes podcast store. So open that up, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, leave your name, drop us 5 stars if you can. There's a little comment box, and in there, write your question. That's how you get in touch. Get on the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, the Science Museum and Equinor, they're opening their Young Imagineers competition for another year. They're challenging you to come up with something innovative that could make the world a better place. So we're talking about ways of using, like, the wild inventions that you can imagine, bring them to life using science. Now, Barry Fitzgerald is a judge of the prize. He is the author of The Secrets of Superhero Science, and he's on the line right now to talk about how we can make superpowers happen in real life. Barry, hello.
Dan, how are you doing?
I am very well, thank you. So now I'm looking at the Science Museum in Equinor, along with the competition. They've done a lot of research about what superpowers kids would like to see. Now, a third of kids say that they would like to have invisibility to make the world a better place. So, invisibility, can it ever be made real?
Invisibility, I think, is one of those powers or abilities that many people are fascinated by. The short answer is yes. To make somebody or something invisible surely is possible. And there are many scientists and researchers who are pursuing this, and they're taking two ways of doing it. So the first way is you make really expensive materials. They're called metamaterials. And what they do is they bend light around objects in ways we don't normally see every day. But the problem with these materials is that they're very, very expensive to make. The cheaper option is that you just use optical lenses and you set them up in a very, very unique and specific way. So they're like the lenses you'd find in a pair of glasses or even in a car headlamp, for example. And I actually have one of these invisibility cloaks on my table in front of me right now.
Right.
So that is an invisibility cloak made of optical lenses.
So what happens when you look at an invisibility cloak that's been made of these optical lenses?
So how it works is it's quite simple. It's 4 optical lenses. So just like, as I say, like the lenses you'd have in a pair of glasses. And you just place them in a certain configuration or a certain way. So they're all on what's called an optical bench to make sure they're all steady. And then you place them at specific locations. And what happens is that when you look in from one end towards the other end, the light will get bent in a certain way so that there will actually be regions which are cloaked. So that, in fact, if you put an object in there, you won't see that object.
Now, is it as simple as just not seeing it? Or perhaps, is it strange when I look at it? Will my eyes be distorted? For instance, I don't know, Barry, if you've ever had like a migraine. And how the migraines start, I always find, is you get like those light spinning round things that occasionally you get when you've looked at light too much. Is it that type of optical illusion? Is it going to be a bit discomforting, or will I not notice it and it will just be as much as anything's not there?
It will be as if it's just as a normal, it's like looking through a pair of binoculars. That's the way to be, or a telescope or a microscope. I suffer from migraines too, and they're very, very something definitely you don't want to be suffering from. But certainly when you look through this, you don't have to worry about getting a migraine from looking through it. And I have it set up here on my desk, and I have an object which I'm trying to cloak or make invisible is actually just a piece of Lego or a Lego bridge. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to look through the other end to see Ant-Man, who's actually at the other end. One of these Ant-Man figures is just standing there. And my hope is that when I look through from one end towards the other, I'll see Ant-Man's face, and I'll find that it's not blocked by the Lego bridge, which means that the invisibility cloak has cloaked or made invisible this Lego bridge.
Right, so the next super strength that kids want through this study, 35% have said that they would like superhuman strength and speed. Now, do scientists have any clue, like, the human's maximum capacity for strength and speed? Because, you know, we're always getting faster, we're always getting stronger. Do we have any idea where it might stop?
I suppose it's about the physiological limitations of the human body. So, for example, let's look back last month. The marathon world record was broken. It's down now to 2 hours and 1 minute 39 seconds, which is extraordinary. And the big aim in the marathon, for example, is trying to get a sub-2-hour marathon. I think we're getting very close towards physical limitations of the human body by itself, and in terms of speed, in terms of strength. And at a certain point, then, we have to look at what I call add-ons to help us do that. Now, luckily, scientists are actually doing that at the moment, and they're looking at making things like exoskeleton suits. So these are like suits that you can wear on the outside of your body, and they allow you to do things more easily or allow you to do things you could not do before. So to give you an example, many military organizations are looking to make exoskeleton suits that make it easier for soldiers to walk carrying very large loads. So many soldiers might have to carry 60 or 70 kilograms of equipment, which can be very tiring for them. And of course, at the end of the day, it's something that could really wear their body out. But if they have an exoskeleton suit, it would allow them to lift more for longer and to walk further with that load. So in order to push the boundaries in terms of strength, I think the way to do that would be to wear an exoskeleton suit, just like, for example, Iron Man. He wears an exoskeleton suit, and he's able to lift objects and carry things that he would not be able to do if he didn't have the suit.
Now, this might be a really stupid question, but going back to your marathon runners, how are we constantly getting faster? Like, what are these runners doing that's making them quicker?
So I actually run. I am definitely not a 2-hour marathon man. Mm-hmm. I am miles away from that. But from my own perspective, how I've got faster is you train, you eat right, you eat healthily, you follow an exercise program, and you strive then to see if that will actually give you the end result of going faster.
But that's to a point, surely, Barry, though. I mean, when you're getting to 205, 204, we're talking about the muscles. How can someone's muscle be so different to everyone else's that they can race through at that pace?
I think what the differences you're seeing there, it comes down to genetics fundamentally. So everybody's different, the DNA is different, and because their DNA is different, everyone's able to do different things. So the example I would give is that with a lot of these runners is that their DNA might be different from my DNA. Now, we both can run. It's just that when they run, they're able to run faster and further because, for example, maybe their muscles have been designed in a way that they're able to keep going for longer. They don't get tired as quickly. And I think one of the biggest examples is there's an ultra-marathon runner called Dean Parnassus. This man can run incredible distances. I'll give you an example. He's run 560 kilometers in about 72 or 78 hours nonstop without sleeping. He only stops to eat. He doesn't sleep. Now, he says that he doesn't get muscle cramp in the same way that I would get muscle cramp, or many people would get muscle cramp after the exercise. And this has to come down fundamentally to his genetics, how his body is designed, what's in his DNA, because his DNA has something I just don't have.
And lastly, 33% of kids, in order to make the world a better place, they'd like to travel through time. This has been something that scientists and people have dreamed about, for centuries. Is it possible at all?
Time travel is possible. Absolutely possible. You can go forward in time. It's complicated. What you need to do is you need to take a rocket to go into outer space. You need to find yourself a nice black hole. You need to go into orbit around that black hole. Not too close, because you don't want to get sucked in, but you just want to be some distance away from the black hole and stay in orbit around that black hole for some time. And then when you pop out from the orbit, you'll find that you've actually traveled to the future. And this is all because of how Albert Einstein's famous theory of general relativity describes how basically time can slow down in space when you're close to very large gravitational objects. Now, perhaps I'm not seeing something, and maybe one of the people that enters this Young Imagineers competition will maybe come up with another way to time travel. And it's something that I certainly would love to see. I would love to see, for example, a real DeLorean car like they had in Back to the Future that can actually time travel. That may be a long way off, but maybe, as I say, maybe I'm missing something, and hopefully one of the entries in the Young Imagineers competition will see something that I don't.
Brilliant. Well, Barry, yeah, so the Science Museum in Equinor's Young Imagineers competition, it's still open right now, so if you're quick about it, if you find out online, you can come up with a really great idea that could change the way that the world works in the future. Barry, yeah, thank you so much for coming on. Brilliant. It's been great to talk to you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Danny.
Time for this week's Dangerous Dan there, where we look at the most mean and evil things in the universe. Today, we're chatting about one of the most cruel killers in the whole of the wild. And you know what? It's a little bit of a surprise. Now, a shrew is a tiny mole-like creature. Look a little bit like a hedgehog, kind of spiky, also mixed with a mouse because they've got ears and they've got a long nose as well, which kind of seems like an anteater. And the northern short-tailed shrew is one of the very few venomous mammals. But it's not the venom itself that makes it brutal, it's what it does with the prey after it's bitten it. The shrew's venom, it will paralyze the prey, so the mouse or the small bird, a creature like that, so it means they can't move away. But it doesn't kill them quickly. No. The shrew, it keeps them alive for as long as it can. The creature just lies there, paralyzed in the corner, while the shrew keeps coming back and feeds on it whenever it wants. It's kind of having like a buffet dinner in the corner, always open, always nice and toasty for you. Finally, though, after a few days of being eaten, while they're still alive, the poor prey will finally succumb to the injuries and it will die. Now, a shrew can eat its own body weight every day for ages. They just keep stuff in their faces. They're constantly hungry. Now, their poison itself, to humans, it's quite useful. It can treat diseases, migraines, even help with wrinkles. But if you're a small critter, the northern short-tailed shrew is one of the biggest, most dangerous threats that you have. So let's get an episode of Britain's Digital Railways on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is our series where Bex from the Club on Fun Kids and me, we take a tour all around the UK on the rails, looking at how trains of the future are going to be made better.
Britain's Digital Railway. Stations are where passengers begin their journey. Whether that journey is on a train, tram or tube, they're a really important part of the rail network. And with over 3,000 of them across Britain, they really do come in all shapes and sizes. Some are fairly small and may just have one platform, whilst others, often in cities or places where passengers make connections to other parts of the country, have many platforms, connected by footbridges or underpasses. Sometimes these stations might also be underground. Bex and Dan find out more.
Only three more stops, Bex. Nearly there.
It feels like we've stopped at 1,000 stations already. But it is funny how they're all kind of different.
Oh, man, there's a snack shop with cake. I'm starving. Do you think we've got time for a quick slice?
I doubt it. Looks nice though.
Many things you'll see at stations are there to help your journey. Ticket offices or machines to buy tickets, timetables to help plan journeys, and departure boards and station staff to tell you when trains are leaving and from which platform. Through speakers, you'll also hear messages to keep people up to date and information to keep people safe. There's something all stations have. Platforms. You can't get on a train without them. To help passengers get on and off the train, tube or tram, it's best when platforms are of a certain height, generally the same height as the doors. Really old platforms might vary in height and not suit modern rail vehicles. In London, deep tube trains are much smaller and lower than overground trains, something that's very obvious when they share the same platform. A way of keeping passengers safe is by making sure the gap between the train and the platform is as small as possible. Otherwise, people might fall onto the track when getting on or off. It's best if platforms are straight, so that the staff can see the whole train when preparing to close the doors. But sometimes, that's not always possible. Some of London's underground tube lines were built to follow the route of the roads above, and are sometimes very twisty. And as modern tube carriages are longer compared to their Victorian counterparts, at some stations, you might need to...
mind the gap.
You should always stay behind the yellow line on the platform. Trains can pass at speed, and you don't want to get caught in the draft.
Oh, but why are they called platforms? Because I thought platforms were things that were kind of high up. They don't seem very high.
Well, most platforms are higher than the track. If they weren't raised, you need a stepladder to get onto the train, like in some parts of Europe.
Oh, looks like we're on the move.
Hey, look! There's another kind of station. It's a freight depot.
As well as passengers, the railways carry freight around the country, taking heavy traffic off the roads, which is good for the environment. Freight trains need their own type of station, where goods are loaded from lorries and ships onto trains, from train to train, and from trains onto lorries. Sometimes you find them near to passenger stations, although larger freight depots might be separate and near to ports or motorway junctions. Today, freight is generally either carried in containers or in special wagons to carry materials such as coal, metals, oil and aggregates.
That's cool. It's good to know that railways are helping take lorries off the roads.
Yeah. Although I don't think you get a slice of cake as easily at a freight station.
Britain's Digital Railway. With support from the Royal Academy of Engineering. Find out more at bunkidslive.com/railway.
Let's talk about this week's science that has been all over the news then. Scientists say that embracing a flexitarian diet could help climate change. Eating mainly plant-based food, with the occasional bit of meat and fish thrown in there as well. They say it's one of the key steps towards a sustainable future being reached by 2050, because it will limit water scarcity, pollution, and the world's ongoing heating issue. Also, the German Space Agency has released a 3D map of the Earth. It's built from images acquired by radar satellites, and it traces the height changes across the whole of the planet, which is an area totaling more than 148 million square miles. It's free, it's open, so any scientist can use this map to help their work. And finally, scientists have found that fast fashion is a major source of greenhouse gas. Getting clothes made and flown over the planet quickly is a cause of overheating the world. And when the clothes have been worn, it doesn't get much better, because they clog up landfill sites, and often they end up floating around and polluting the ocean. That is it for this week's episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. Remember, if you are listening to this in time or on around the 20th, and if you've got an idea that you think could change the world, if you want to win a prize, get online, search for that Science Museum competition, Young Imagineers. That's what you need to look up online. Also, while you are on the internet, make sure you give the Fun Kids Science Weekly a review on the iTunes podcast store. Chuck your name in there so I know who you are and I can say hello. 5 stars would be amazing, and it is the best place if you've got a science question that you want answered by an expert, that you can tell me about it and I can find someone to sort it for you. Leave it as a review on the iTunes podcast store. While you're on iTunes, you can find all of our brilliant Fun Kids Science series. They're on the free Fun Kids app. You can listen to them at funkidslive.com as well, and you can find Fun Kids at the kids radio station all around the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app, and we're over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello everyone, I'm Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm just popping in to tell you about my new book series, Which Way to Anywhere. It's a story about 4 children who discover that there are alternative worlds beyond our own, and that they can travel to them with the help of a magical map and a very special gift. Of course, this leads to epic, unexpected adventures. Which Way to Anywhere and its sequel, Which Way Round the Galaxy, are both available to buy now. Happy reading!